The Buddha referred to our experience in any given moment as being comprised of five core components or types of aggregates. Aggregates is a sort of terrible word, but it's the word that's generally used to when they translate the phrase khandhas, which is basically the components of that make up our experience at any given moment. And he said there are five, because the Buddha liked to break things down into smaller, easier to work with units. He didn't like to look at big, large conglomerations of things. He liked to break things down so that he could work with the building blocks that cause us stress and suffering. So what are the five building blocks that make up our experience? Well, the first is our sensations of the body, how the body feels at any given moment. Those are in Pali, rupa. And that's how your body feels right now. Then there's feelings, vedana. You know, those feelings, you feel good, you feel bad, you feel indifferent. It's sort of the way the mind talks to us through the body. So feelings are different from body sensations in that body sensations are things that we carry around for extended periods of time. For instance, you can have an aching body, a body that feels sore if you've exercised. You can have a body that feels stiff. You get the idea. Your body has a certain tone to it. And then also, there's those gut feelings that change all the time as you encounter different things in life. Somebody might give you like a tuna melt to eat, and you take a bite of the tuna melt and it tastes delicious, and you have ooh, that's nice, I like a tuna melt filling, and your stomach feels good, it relaxes, there's a sensation of ooh, I'm enjoying this moment in your body. That's a feeling. Or you cannot like the taste of the tuna melt, it can taste disgusting to you, and then for you might have a feeling of ooh, this is horrible, I don't like what's going on. Very often in life when we're stressed out, there's that feeling of just the entire body just wishing that what we're going through would go away, like we could push things away. So that's feelings, vedana. Then there are perceptions, pana, which is the way we perceive and label the world. Sometimes the exact same sensation, a ringing phone, can be labeled or perceived in entirely different ways depending upon how much stress or tranquility we're in. If we're relaxed, the phone might be, oh good, a phone call. But on the other hand, if you're stressed out, a phone ringing could be, why the fuck don't they leave me alone? That could be the tag underneath it. If you ever see advertisements, there was this old exercise where they would put different taglines beneath the same image, and just by changing the tagline, an image can mean hugely different things. So the way we perceive the world, the way we label our experience, very much what we focus on, it plays an enormous role on how much stress and suffering we go through in a day-to-day experience. There's so much to perceive in any given moment, so much to focus on. So what the mind focuses on and how it labels it is very much plays a role. There's consciousness itself. Sometimes the mind feels, which is vinana, and consciousness can be, sometimes you feel alert and energized, your mind feels bright and ready to go, and sometimes you feel dull and energyless and foggy. So the mind, or just the pure feeling of your consciousness can have very different feelings. And finally, there are dhammas, which are thoughts, basically your mental content, what your world view is at any given moment, what you're thinking about. And that's what I'm going to start with, because I love talking about thinking. I do a lot of it, talking and thinking. Talk about the ways that thinking can cause us stress and suffering, the way we can work with our thoughts to reduce the amount of stress and suffering in our lives. So dhammas is the Pali word for it. And you might notice dhamma is, of course, what the Buddha taught. So the Buddha himself taught a mental content, a way of looking at the world, an interpretation or a set of thoughts. So some thoughts, like what the Buddha taught, can bring us peace and tranquility or a greater sense of calm. Many of the thoughts that we have in our minds can bring us stress and suffering. There was a fascinating article in the New York Times about a week ago in the mind section about those thoughts that we don't want to think, inappropriate thoughts that come up and we fight against them. I don't know if you've ever had that when you're at a dinner party and you want to have this, you have this thought of really wanting to insult somebody. You might be meeting the parents of your girlfriend or boyfriend and you want to say something totally inappropriate that suddenly jumps into your head. We all have these thoughts that jump in, and the more we try to fight them, the more difficult it is to quiet them, of course. And there's a whole book about it, a neuroscience book called White Bears. If you want to look it up, it's all about how when you how persistent thoughts, how obsessive persistent thoughts can be so difficult to banish, the thoughts that we don't want to think, how much of a struggle it can be to work with them. There's a study where they told tennis players and soccer players not to hit or move the ball in one specific area. They told the soccer players not to kick it in the lower left hand, towards the lower left hand side of the goal, and the tennis players not to hit the ball towards the left, just in a pickup game. And they noticed when whatever they would tell the tennis players and the soccer players not to do, they would invariably do more of. Because once you tell somebody not to do something, most of us have no clue how to banish that thought. Most of us find our thoughts, especially the troubling ones, very, very difficult to work with. The reason is because the thoughts we have actually can produce stress in the body. There's a mind-body connection that's through the amygdala. When you have a stressful thought, it triggers the amygdala, which causes stress in the body. And the more stress you have in the body, it turns out, the more difficult it is to get rid of a thought. So it creates this vicious cycle. The thought creates stress. The more stress we have, the more difficult it is to banish an obsessive, worrying thought. Could be a thought about what's going to happen to me, how much money do I have, what is my friend thinking about me, what's going to happen to me at work, what's going to happen to me when I go on this trip, what's blah, blah, blah. We all have these thoughts that we're worried about, and they cause a certain amount of stress. The more stress they have, the more we try to push away and fight the thought, the more difficult it is to work with. Now, you might throw up your hands like the New York Times articles seem to do, and say, well, what is there to do? But actually, they didn't do their research, because actually there's actually a lot of studies that show that there are ways of working with obsessive thoughts that plague us. There are ways to actually deal with them. The first, of course, is to what we did earlier tonight. We meditated, we relaxed the body. By focusing your awareness on the body and relaxing it, there's a lot of studies that show that you can reduce the prevalence and the effectivity of obsessive interfering thoughts. The less stress you feel, the less likely you are to act out on a certain thought. But then there's another fascinating experiment called the marshmallow experiment. I don't know how many of you have heard about the marshmallow experiment. I don't have marshmallows, which would be fun because I could do the marshmallow experiment with all of you. It's actually done with actually six-year-olds, so you'd all probably do pretty well. It was done in the 1960s where they gave a marshmallow to just dozens of six-year-olds, and they said, if you can be in a room with this marshmallow for 10 minutes without eating it, I will come back and give you another marshmallow. So you'll wind up with two marshmallows. All you have to do is not eat that marshmallow for 10 minutes. Now, I know for a fact, from the kind of kid I was when I was six, I probably would have eaten it right before they even left the room. I had so much impulse control at that age. But they noticed as they went, as they followed the kids that actually managed not to eat the marshmallows, that those kids actually wound up being far more successful in grade school and then high school and then even on in life. They could predict the how happy and how successful people would be simply by whether they would eat the marshmallow or not. Unbelievable, but true. Now, these scientists were clever. They went and they actually studied why is it that some kids could not eat the marshmallow that was sitting there right in front of them on a plate, that plump, juicy, white, pillowy marshmallow, and why other kids could avoid eating the marshmallow. It turns out that the kids who didn't eat the marshmallow would distract themselves with other things. They would look around the room. They would start talking with an imaginary friend. They would pick up something that was in the room and play with it. They would purposely distract themselves with something purposeful so that they wouldn't have to sit there and not try to eat the marshmallow. Most of us, though, in life, when we have an obsessive thought, we try to fight the thought. Make it go away. I'm not going to think you thought. I want you to go away. Be gone, thought. And then just like in the book, The White Bears, it pops up again and again and again and again and again. And then we think, what's the matter with me? My thoughts don't go away. Actually, the Buddha said the first way of working with stressful, obsessive, interfering thoughts is by substituting them with other thoughts that do not cause stress and suffering. This is actually also the foundation of cognitive behavioral therapy, which works with the exact same presuppositions. Learning to see which thoughts are untrue and cause us stress, and which thoughts cause us relaxation and calm, long-term happiness. So, I have brought you a list of some of the types of thoughts to watch out for, and what to replace them with, because I'm that kind of hands-on type of guy. Okay. The first type of thought that the Buddha mentions, and is also mentioned in a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy, is globalizing thoughts. Globalizing thoughts mean when you have an experience that kind of sucks, or really sucks, or is really stressful, somebody says something unpleasant to you at work, somebody insults you. I just the other day had a horrible meeting where something I created was just completely rejected. Like, they liked nothing of it whatsoever. It's one of just those magical moments where you just want to sort of throw in the towel and become a monk or whatever. And although monks get towels, so you actually get the towel. You get the towel and you become a monk. Forget about it. Anyway, so I wanted to get that moment of wanting to chuck it all in. And we want to chuck it all in because we do what's called globalizing. We take one experience and we think, oh, the rest of my life is going to be shitty, just like this. You get sick and you think, oh, what if it's like I'm always going to feel this way? What if I always feel sick for the rest of my life? Or you might go to a new job, and then new job the first day is kind of stressful because you don't know anybody, you don't know what you're expected of, and any bad news, you're going to think, oh my God, the rest of this job, I'm stuck in this horrible job. What have I done? I've taken a job where they want me to do stuff that I don't know how to do, that I'm sucky at, that I hate doing. I'm in a job that I hate. It's always going to be miserable. That's globalizing. It can be any single experience, taking that experience and saying it's not just for now, it's going to happen again and again and again and again and again. We globalize it. Okay. That, the Buddha said over and over and over again, that type of thinking always causes stress and suffering. The next type of thinking that causes stress and suffering is called fabrication. Taking a whole lot of different experiences and turning them into one generalization. For example, in selfing, how we create a sense of identity. We have all these different thoughts, feelings, sensations. We're constantly changing. But we tend to just focus on a couple of sensations and say that's who we are. For example, Some days we're happy, some days we're depressed, some days we're ambivalent, some moments we're excited, some moments we're not excited, but we find the examples that we're most uncomfortable with when we say, that's who I am. I'm a depressed person. I was depressed today. I was depressed a few days ago. I was depressed last week. I am a depressed person. We generalize. We take a whole bunch of different things and fabricate them into a single specific generality. We don't look at the differences. We just look at, we take all these differences and we smush them together and we just say, I'm a smart but depressed person. I'm a caring but smart depressed person. I'm a this kind of person. We constantly create a sense of identity or identity to things that causes us stress and suffering. Why does this cause stress and suffering? Because we're constantly changing. Anytime we say, that's who I am, it cages us in. If you really believe, for example, that you're a caring person, if that's what you say your identity is, because a lot of the times in your life you're caring, if you cling to that idea, then what will happen when those days occur when you don't give a shit about anybody? When you're in a selfish mood or you're just tired and you just can't care or you just need to focus on yourself for a little while. What happens? Anytime we cling and we reduce our experience to that's complex into a single thing, we set ourselves up for disappointment and a sense of being jailed in, caged in. Because no matter how we try to define ourselves and other people, we're not going to fit into the definitions. We're all much more, our experience is much wider and more complex than anything that we can, any little category that we can consume it in or put it in, any little box. So fabrication or generalization also causes stress and suffering. Craving, believing that there's only, if only I had that one thing, if only I had that, that new piece of furniture, that new job, that boyfriend, that girlfriend, that banjo. Yeah, I like banjos. If only I had this one thing. If only I had a car. If only I had that one thing. That one thing external. That would fix everything. Everything would be so much better. I'd be happier. Everything would be fixed. I just need that thing, that, you know, give me that one new state of being. Just get me that thing, whatever. Whatever it is people fixate or crave, drug addicts often, it might be the next hit, the next drink. But it also could be other people could have just, if only I could just get through this project at work. Once I'm through with this project, or once I'm through with school, once I graduate from school, it can be craving a different state. It can be, once I graduate, once I've got my PhD, once I've got my college degree, once I've been at my job and I have health insurance, whatever. You get the idea. There's a sense that there's something missing in our lives, and that if we had that one thing, we then would have permission to be happy. And of course, what the Buddha taught is that we do not need anything to be happy. You have all the tools right now you need to be tranquil and calm and peaceful. You don't need anything. That idea that you need something, that you need to attain another state, another place, you need to be on a beach on holiday, that you need to be on a weekend to be happy and relaxed. It's an illusion. It's an illusion because true happiness comes from within. There's nothing external that can bring us true happiness. Then, of course, there's ill will and anger, resentment. Of course, we also carry around this idea that one person in our life, that person at our work, or those people, if only that I didn't have to deal with that person. If only they would go away, then I'd be happier. Then my life would be fixed, would be solved. Everything would be good. I'd be relaxed. I wouldn't have to worry. I'd be in a much better place if only this person were different. So It's the same thing as craving, but the exact opposite. Every time we are running towards something, as in craving, or running away from something, as in ill will, we're doing the same thing. We're saying that I don't have what it takes to be happy. Also, when you think about it, how could somebody else's misery ever bring us lasting happiness? It can't. The only thing wishing somebody ill will do is basically make our happiness and peace of mind contingent on the suffering of another being. And how sad really is that? So, those are types of thinking that... finally, the last one I'll give you, because I'll give you five. It's a nice round number. Taking things personally. The Buddha said that one of the core ways we cause ourselves suffering is whenever we go through an experience in life, we tend to think, why is this happening to me? To me. Why, you know, for instance, a friend of ours might move away. Somebody we know might get ill or die. There might be, we might lose a job. We might experience a setback. And the mind, one of the first things it does is it takes it personally. Why is this happening to me? And of course what that does is it puts us over here and the rest of the world over there. There's a sense of I'm being singled out by the universe for suffering and stress. That this is all happening to me, that other people have not been through loss. And of course the first thing that the Buddha would do when people were going through stress and suffering would be to remind them that these are the universal conditions of life. In life, you get a nice package. What's in that package? Stress, suffering, right? There's old age, sickness, death. There's not getting what you want. There's losing what you love. I mean, there's good things too, but we all tend to think, well, the good things, it's not happening. It's not personal, right? It's not personal. But when bad things happen, why am I singled out for this suffering? So the Buddha wanted us to see that when you are born into a human body, you can expect a whole bunch of shit to happen as well as the good stuff. And when we go to the doctor and we find out, you know, that we've got something we need to take care of or something that's a problem, it doesn't mean something's wrong. It actually means something right is going on, because that's what bodies do. They do break down, actually. So there's nothing, that doesn't mean we shouldn't take care of ourselves. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't act and deal with challenges in life. But all this storytelling we do about how we are being singled out, why is this happening to me? This is a great cause for stress and suffering. So, once we recognize we're in these kinds of thinking, what kinds of thinking should we replace them with? We're at the marshmallow, right? We want to focus on something that will bring us long-term peace and tranquility. So there are a whole bunch of recollections that the Buddha recommended as being extremely good seeds for planting long-term happiness and peace of mind. The first is to recollect simply the story of course, the Buddha, which is that you don't need to have anything to attain peace of mind. You don't need anything. You don't need any money, any goods, it helps to have money to pay the rent, but it doesn't, in terms of finding long-term peace of mind, the Buddha found it by going off into the jungles, giving up everything he owned, and just meditating, living off of very little for 6 years. That's what recollection of the Buddha means. Just recollecting that it's not about remembering the actual historical being, it's just remembering that as a human being we have all that we need to find inner tranquility. It starts with, as we did earlier today, working with the body, relaxing the body sensations. As I'll talk about in the next few weeks, we work with feelings and perceptions. But all of this stuff is very much a practice that we don't need to accumulate or get rid of anything in the external world. Recollecting that true peace of mind can come from within and also from certain actions basically gives us permission to not crave, to not get caught up by hatred and ill will. And it also gets us out of that cul-de-sac of fixation with identity belief. It's a very good thing to recollect that all human beings can achieve happiness and tranquility if they practice at it, if they put the effort into it. A next one is recollecting appreciation, things that we're appreciative about, gratitude, things that we feel we've done well, things that we're grateful for in our lives. Gratitude for our happiness, gratitude for our, the things we've accomplished. Rather than focusing on the things we haven't done, focusing on the things we believe we need, the states that we believe we need to attain to achieve happiness, take the mind and focus it on a list of things that we feel show a sense of worthiness, an accomplishment, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of showing that we have already led, that we're not coming from a place of lack. When we feel like we're coming from a place of lacking things, it creates so much stress. On the other hand, if we focus on gratitude for the skillful actions we've done, it can completely change the stress levels in our body, and it opens up the mind and makes the mind feel less contracted and claustrophobic. Of course, all these thoughts are like seeds. At first, when you plant them, they take a little bit of energy, but eventually they grow and they water and they will produce a lot longer-term tranquility than the stressful thoughts that create more stress and become obsessions. Another thought is thoughts on virtue, recollecting the times in life when we could have acted unskillfully, but we didn't. Recollecting the times that we acted with compassion and virtue. There's this old saying that if you would not commit a murder, even if I offered you $1 million to kill somebody, you have something that's worth $1 million. Nobody can buy that virtue from you. You have something that's worth so much because you have something that a lot of people actually don't have. There are a lot of people that will kill and steal at the blink of an eye. But if you have virtue in refusing to kill, steal, if you refrain as much as you can from lying, if you refrain from causing harm through sex and through causing harm through intoxication, you have a set of foundations for happiness, virtuous practices that will actually bring you not only a very positive sense of self, but will give you a sense of guidance through life that's much wiser and more dependable than what most people use to guide themselves through life. Most people guide themselves by what other people think. We judge how successful we've been when people like us. We feel there's something wrong when people don't like us. And of course, there's nothing wrong. In fact, we should surround ourselves with wise spiritual practitioners. But if we have a firm set of virtuous principles that we follow, there's this inner sense that we can rely on ourselves, that we don't have to worry about how we're going to act in any given situation, that no matter what we're put into, no matter what situation we're in, we know we can depend on ourselves to act in a certain way that will plant longer-term happiness. Then if we're not sure how we're going to behave, there's a sense of anxiety if we go into situations and we don't know, well, am I going to lose it? Am I going to freak out? Am I going to scream at somebody? What am I going to do? Having a set of virtuous principles that we reflect on brings long-term peace of mind and happiness. Another set of thoughts that bring long-term peace of mind, I'll end it with this because I've given you so much to chew on, but is finally reflecting on the Dhamma itself, which is summarized basically by the idea that We are the authors of our own stress and our own happiness, our own tranquility and our own mental agitation. Every thought and every action we take plants seeds. And those seeds, some of them will grow. Some of them will grow into weeds that will choke our garden. Or, this is a terrible metaphor, but whatever. Some of these seeds we're planting with our thoughts and our actions, they're going to grow and they're going to turn into things that we can't get rid of. Or they're going to be very difficult to get rid of. Let's put it that way. Other seeds we plant will grow into wonderful, beautiful things. So we have to watch what we're doing. Focus on what thoughts, what actions we're acting out on. And when we reflect on the fact that if we're stressed out, that it's not caused generally by something out there, but actually caused by expectations or by previous actions and thoughts, if we turn the focus on what can I focus on right now, what can I think, what kind of thoughts can I cultivate, our chances of finding long-term peace of mind are far greater than if we try to change the people around us or try to change the world to make it exactly the way we want it to be. Now, that's not to say that wanting to change the world for the better is a bad thing, but you're far more likely to succeed if you come from a place of being relaxed than if you come from a place of anger. I know from doing a lot of work in my life, I was one of the, in my 20s, constantly marching. I was a member of Citizens in Solidarity with the people of El Salvador. I had my own little CIA, FBI page, whatever. And but one of the things that happened, I noticed, is that a lot of my work was being fueled by anger. Anger at our government, anger at Republicans, anger at... Yeah, but, you know, anger at what's going on. And I found that when your work is fueled by anger, in my case, I burn out. But when our work is fueled by compassion, wanting to be generous, wanting to help other people, not from anger, then it's a kind of energy that can last forever. There is no burning out when our actions are fueled by compassion for other people. But if our actions are fueled by hatred and anger or resentment or by a sense that we're going to get even, that kind of energy burns out. It burns through us and it leaves us spent and it leaves us bitter. So by all means, try to first create an inner tranquil, peaceful environment and then turn that compassion and that generosity and that sense of responsibility and virtue towards the world to help it out as much as you can. So that is working with thoughts, how thoughts cause us stress and suffering, what kinds of thoughts don't cause us stress and suffering, and how to eat marshmallows. All in one talk. So now it's your turn to ask any questions that might have arisen. And thank you for listening.